I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Discussion versus documentation. The gap between the two was on full display today during the fourth day of testimony in the federal corruption trial of indicted Philadelphia Congressman Chaka Fattah. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports that defense lawyers sought to cut down one of the government's key witnesses.
Tom Lindenfeld is a high-profile campaign consultant who worked on Fattah's failed bid for Philadelphia mayor in 2007. Lindenfeld has testified that the congressman knew about an illegal $1 million loan made to help the flailing campaign late in the election season, as well as a scheme to repay $600,000 of that loan. How? Lindenfeld says he discussed it all with Fattah, every step of the way, not via emails or other documents, but verbally. Sam Silver, one of Fattah's lawyers, maintained that his client had nothing to do with the loan, that Lindenfeld and another consultant on the campaign were the ones pulling the strings. To help prove it, Silver showed jurors copies of documents tied to the sham loan, which was made to Lindenfeld's political consulting firm, not Fattah's campaign. Fattah's name is nowhere to be found, ditto for his signature. Prosecutors contend that was all done on purpose, to keep Fattah removed from the illegal activity. Lindenfeld is one of two people who has pleaded guilty in connection to the case. In addition to brokering the $1 million loan, Lindenfeld says he launched a fake nonprofit that received federal grants with Fattah's help. This after Fattah was unable to pay Lindenfeld for work he did on the mayoral campaign. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
With time running out for a final budget deal, many in Philadelphia City Council are working on ways to avoid voting for a sugary drink tax. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that a new proposal is drawing both support and opposition.
I guess the rubber's getting ready to meet the road. We're going to have to make some grown-up decisions coming up.
That's Councilman Curtis Jones during City Council's regular session, reminding his colleagues that a budget is due and the deliberating time is almost up. Also during the weekly session, Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds Brown introduced a bill that would impose a 15-cent tax on containers, regardless of what type of beverage is inside, in order to raise money without taxing soda and sugary beverages.
Our numbers tell us that we could conservatively yield $64 to $78 million. So does it fall short of the current proposal in front of us? It does, but we still have to actually negotiate that current proposal in front of us, and we're not there yet. So this becomes a part of those negotiations and continued discussions.
Council President Darrell Clark says he's interested in the container tax proposal, but Council Majority Leader Bobby Heenan was quick to criticize the idea.
The introduction of a container tax proposal made the myth of a grocery tax a reality. The container tax touches nearly every drink on your grocery store shelves. Compared to the sugar-sweetened beverage, this tax will be impossible to avoid.
During the same council session, Councilwoman Cindy Bass called for hearings on enforcing the existing liquor by the drink tax better.
And it's really an honor system. You can pay something, you know, you pay a little something, they stay off your back. But how much auditing have we done of this program and collection, and how deeply have we looked at it? I don't think we looked at it at all.
She thinks it could collect an additional $36 million. Bass specifically was told by the Revenue Department they don't collect any tax from stop-and-goes, small delis that sell shots of liquor as part of their daily routine. The individual efforts can't match the revenue projected for the sugary drinks tax, which is expected to bring in $95 million a year. Mayor Jim Kenney wants to use that to pay for universal pre-K and repairs to recreation centers, among other things. Council President Clark hinted that a counterproposal is on the way.
When you have a number of proposals, and I agree, when you have a number of ideas, you tend to have a better end game as it relates to a solution for the problem. When you have this one notion that this is the proposal, accept it or not, and not have the willingness to entertain other alternatives or maybe improvements, I don't think you end up with a good process.
Mayor Kenney says the so-called soda tax is the only way to bring in enough to fund the programs. He says a combination of taxes won't be effective.
We're 3 cents an ounce, and that's where we are, and that's what will fund this, and all the other jumping through hoops is not going to change the fact that that's where the money can come from with very little pain.
Council normally tries to settle these issues by the end of May, but the hard deadline is the end of June. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Philadelphia is a city of neighborhoods, 372 of them by one measure. Let's learn the extent to which gentrification is playing a role in the evolving cityscape with Larry Eichel, director of Pew's Philadelphia Research Initiatives. Larry, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Great to be back, Dave.
Larry, the newly released study from Pew is called Philadelphia's Changing Neighborhoods, Gentrification and Other Shifts Since the Year 2000. Let's start with that first number, though, 372. How was that arrived at?
That's the number of residential census tracts in the city, and that's really the smallest unit for which there's a lot of data. That's why we chose it.
Why don't we get a working definition of the term gentrification?
There is no universally accepted definition of the term. We set up a definition that said, essentially, to have gentrified in this period, you had to have been a relatively low-income neighborhood to start, you've had a significant increase over the period, and in the end, you had to be sort of above the middle in the city. We wanted to rule out sort of low-income neighborhoods that got a little less low-income.
So with that in mind, it seems that this focus is principally targeted at Northern Liberties and the Graduate Hospital area.
Those are among the areas that gentrified. We, in fact, found that gentrification in the city is not monolithic. It's happened in four different types of neighborhoods, and these types are based on what the neighborhoods look like at the start in 2000. You have predominantly African-American working-class neighborhoods like Graduate Hospital. You have old industrial areas like Northern Liberties. You have mixed-income white sort of middle-class neighborhoods, most of which are in South Philadelphia, that gentrified. And you have some pockets around and in Center City that were not affluent in 2000 and have seen their incomes go up.
So given that range, you can't universally say that these are neighborhoods that were among Philadelphia's lowest income areas.
No, in fact, they weren't. The neighborhoods that ultimately gentrified were not among the lowest income areas.
Is that a surprise?
I think we sort of started with the idea the areas that gentrify, location is a big part of why they gentrify. All these neighborhoods are relatively close to the center of the city, and that obviously plays a part. And one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that our report covers a specific time period, 2010 to 2014. So when we say these are the areas that gentrified, we're saying these are the areas gentrified in that time period.
Now, right in the middle of that time period was the depth of the recession.
Correct.
Was that a catalyst for change?
No, I don't think so. But it explains why we can say that a 10% increase in real income over a period was significant, because overall income in the city went down. But in this analysis, we do not capture areas that may have gentrified before 2000, areas that gentrified in the last year or two, or that are currently in the process of gentrifying.
Could one look at this analysis and make a determination whether gentrification in these sections has been a stabilizing or destabilizing influence overall?
It depends what you mean. If you're looking for population turnover, you certainly see that in some areas. Graduate Hospital is the most remarkable in that regard. And
how so?
Graduate Hospital in the year 2000 had about 10,000 residents. About 8,000 of them were African American. In the most recent numbers, it has about 11,500 residents, and only 3,500 of them are African American. So during that period, the black population essentially fell by more than half, the white population more than tripled.
Where did the black population go?
We don't really know. We made some effort in this report to try to track people on a selective basis. We took a few blocks, one in Graduate Hospital, one in Northern Liberties, and essentially looked to see who had sold homes during the period we were looking and where they wound up. Hard to do sometimes because the names are common, and we could only look in Pennsylvania for this. We found about half of the people, and most of them ended up in areas that had lower median incomes than the tracts that they left.
Larry, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Larry Eichel is director of Pew's Philadelphia Research Initiative. The just-released study is called Philadelphia's Changing Neighborhoods, Gentrification, and Other Shifts Since the Year 2000. We'll have a link to that study on our website, newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, many products claim to taste homemade, but a pasta sauce sold in local supermarkets is the real deal.
I realized that I had no packaging, no shelf life, no nothing other than just my product. So I walk into the meeting with a Tupperware of pasta sauce.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This weekend, Philadelphia is hosting the annual convention of the American Institute of Architects. Plan Philly's Ashley Hahn has been asking local architects to share their favorite underdog buildings in the city. She met Jules Dingle of Digsaw on Spring Garden Street to hear why he admires a nearby building, Guildhouse. It's an early work of Philadelphia's own Robert Venturi. He and partner Denise Scott Brown will receive the AIA's gold medal tonight, its highest honor. Guildhouse is a six-story tall brick building from the early 1960s. Its symmetrical facade rests on a giant polished granite column at the entrance, and its upper floor is topped with a long, low, arched window. Huge lettering above the entry proclaims its name to passersby. Now, while Guildhouse may look unremarkable to today's eye, Dingle says it was groundbreaking in its day.
It appears very much to be ordinary mid-century aggregate affordable housing. The intent, especially in a time of very heroic and abstract modernism, one of the goals of this project was to get in touch with the human experience. In another way, this building is often pegged as the progenitor of postmodernism in architecture, and with that also it has become the scapegoat for everything that name implies. And it was a movement that preoccupied our profession for decades. The reason that I find this building to be lasting and relevant is it's not as much about the form or the planning of the building, but more the philosophy behind its making. And the work of Denise Scott Brown and Bob Venturi and Steve Eisner and everyone in that firm was guided by an open-mindedness that, as they put it, allowed them to deal with the messy vitality of what was really a radically changing world around them. So their work acknowledges conflict, it celebrates ordinary, it realizes the value of juxtaposition and, of course, humor. So as a city, I think we should be really proud that Bob Venturi and Denise Scott Brown are receiving the gold medal later this week at the AIA National Convention, and of all places, right here in Philadelphia.
Architect Jules Dingle talking about Guildhouse, his pick for favorite Philadelphia underdog building. He spoke with Plan Philly's Ashley Hahn. Fabric is central to the work of artist Anne Hamilton, whose exhibit, Cloth, A Commonplace, is still being formed as we speak. The National Medal of Arts recipient joins me in conversation on NewsWorks tonight. Anne, thanks for joining us here in Philadelphia.
It's great to be here.
So this notion of a commonplace isn't a commonplace like a site, but it actually alludes to a description of a collection of texts or books that actually goes back centuries.
Right. It's the practice of collecting texts that one wants to remember and for organizing knowledge. And so originally they were handwritten notations, often from someone's reading, sometimes original writing. Early examples have drawings, diagrams in them. A little bit different than a scrapbook, more a collection of literary fragments. And
still vital in this age of Wikipedia?
I think so, yeah. Well, it's interesting because it's a very old form, but on Tumblr and Twitter, I think you have contemporary forms of sharing quotations and sharing things that you want to remark upon. But it doesn't necessarily collect in a physical object. So we are also borrowing examples of early commonplace books from the Rosenbach Library. And those are all handwritten and this beautiful cursive, which we're actually losing the training of our eye to be able to read.
Previously explored this notion of thread and thread as a line and lines creating words on a page. This seems to be another iteration of that.
Very much so. So I sort of started thinking about how the word text and the word textiles share the same four letters. And that to describe the quality or the feeling of a cloth touching you is something that's a challenge to really our vocabulary. How do you describe the weight of a hand or the brush of a particular kind of cloth? And so I'm really interested in that experience that can be made through language, that can evoke a tactile experience in relationship to the feeling of the surround or the weight of a cloth that you're actually wearing.
Yeah. Let's talk about this process now in real time as cloth, a commonplace, will evolve ultimately into the exhibit entitled A Social Fabric.
Right. So there, right now we're very focused on the collection on a Tumblr site of fragments from literature and from writing that make a reference to textile vocabularies. So a commonplace traditionally is authored by a single person. It's your private collection. In this case, we've made a Tumblr site, and so we're making a collective collection of literatures that make this reference, and we're asking for public donations to that. So the site is live, and then the submissions will become part of the exhibition at the Fabric Workshop.
As an artist and as a teacher visiting us in Philadelphia, I must ask you to weigh in, if you will, on districts who have limited budgets, who in their wisdom first cross out or reduce arts programs.
Right. It's a disaster. It's a disaster because education is not about information only, you know, and I think that what happens when those programs go to the side and they're seen as unnecessary, that then you're not cultivating a kind of intelligence that's informed by imagination. And that, you know, if we can't grow a culture where we can imagine things differently than how they are, then where are we?
Schools are less and less frequently teaching script writing.
I know. Or they teach it and you don't use it, so you never practice it. And, you know, I don't know if I'm just totally 19th century or if it's really about bringing forward into the present forms of attention that we as beings still really need.
I'm getting the sense that you're totally 22nd century.
Oh,
thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much.
Ann Hamilton, the exhibit starting this fall is A Social Fabric. The Tumblr site now up and running is Cloth a Commonplace. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Sometimes life doesn't turn out the way we plan. For Katie Robbins, a second try at a first career has led her from her parents' kitchen to the refrigerated shelves of more than 25 local supermarkets with a locally made, small-batch, veggie-based pasta sauce. WHYY's resident food blogger Marilyn DeAngelo reports.
With her undergrad at Penn State and her master's degree in school counseling from Holy Family, Katie Robbins thought for sure she'd follow in her parents' footsteps. With a stable job, a long career, and a pension down the line. But at 28, without any viable job options, she realized she'd soon need a backup plan. For Robbins, inspiration came in the form of a passion for food, and ultimately with a connection to family. It all started with her father, Rick.
Over the years, I've kind of made the sauce for my father. His famous words are, he won't eat anything green. So I kind of tricked him, I guess, into making a vegetable sauce instead of the meat sauce. And so for years now, he's been eating it, thinking it's meat. Now he knows that it's not meat.
Robbins prepares and distributes a line of vegan and vegetarian pasta sauces from her parents' kitchen in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The sauce begins with a chunky base of pureed zucchini, yellow squash, button mushrooms and onions, ingredients she picks up from Tanner's brother's farm, about 3 minutes from her house. In the beginning, she'd sell her sauce at a local farmer's market in Brynathyn. But in 2015, Robin's company, The Taste of Tuscany, officially broke into the mainstream. Early this year, she delivered her first batch of sauce to her local Whole Foods market in nearby Jenkintown.
Got off the phone and, you know, was jumping up and down, and I realized that I had no packaging, no shelf life, no nothing other than just my product and that my certification, you know, for making the product. So I walk into the meeting with a Tupperware of pasta sauce, just a regular Tupperware.
The meeting was intimidating, but Robbins leaned in. She asked the men in the room to just give it a try. One of those men was Craig McCormick, a grocery associate team leader at Whole Foods. She left the meeting not knowing where things would go, but McCormick was sold.
I was really pulling for her because I felt inspired myself and that here's someone doing what they absolutely believed in and were giving it everything they had.
McCormick helped Robbins through the onboarding process, allowing a taste of Tuscany's vegetarian and now marinara goddess to join the 10 to 30% of products in a typical Whole Foods store that are locally produced. Before she could be an approved supplier, the Department of Agriculture came out to inspect her parents' kitchen. She also had to prove that she could keep the shelves full. Today, she cranks out between 400 and 500 bags a week. Yes, bags. Filling orders for 25 stores across the region and sharing refrigerated shelf space with other specialty items.
If I just put my pasta sauce in a jar, no one would notice it. There's about 50 jarred pasta sauces out on the market right now. And what's going to make mine stand out? What is going to make people buy my pasta sauce? So I wanted a bag. I wanted it easy for working parents so they could use a little bit and freeze the rest so it doesn't go to waste. Kids like it because it's sweet. And it has tons of vegetables so they can sneak them in.
It's this forward thinking and understanding of her product and her competition that has helped Robbins make such a splash in her first year. And while her business sense helps, ultimately, it's the quality and the flavor that make this product a winner for McCormick.
It tastes fantastic. It's clean, ingredient-wise, and it's local, so it's amazingly fresh. You know, it's very much like you would imagine if your neighbor had a grandma from Italy and this was the sauce that she made and you got to taste it, you know, as she was making it.
And how is she suited for her new culinary career?
I was never one for the entrepreneurial world, but I like it. I really like it.
And she's proud of building so much, so quickly on her own. Marilyn D'Angelo, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.